Hello, I am Kenneth Nichols here with the Great Writers Guild podcast. Today, we have an interview with a very interesting person, Sarah Tregay, the author of Fan Art, a very cool young adult book that you should all pick up from Catherine Tegan Books. Very enjoyable novel about a young man named Jamie who has some problems, but also has some hopes in life. Ms. Tregay talks about how she got her book published, how it was shaped by her agent and her publisher, talks about how she introduced conflict in the book, and all those other kinds of things that writers really need to know. You'll also hear about her love of novels written in verse, and how much she enjoys her fans and interacting with them and enjoying all of the enthusiasm they bring to her work. But first, because this is a book for young adults, written by an adult, I wanted to reflect a little bit on my own experience. There's probably a lot of you out there who might be young adult, young kids, and want to be a writer. Well, you know what? That's all I've ever wanted to be. I remember when I was a kid always wanting to write poems. At one point, I even thought I could write a sequel to A Christmas Story. You know, Ralphie and his brother and all those cool stories. Little did I know that Gene Shepard already did it. I remember going to school on the bus with what I called my poem kit. A red pencil box that had some pens and pencils and note cards, anything I could jot ideas down onto. I don't think I really became a real writer until the day when I was about 12 or 13 years old, when I took my dad's Smith Corona electric typewriter out of its faux leather case and plugged it in, because I had an idea. I had an idea for a story that I wanted to tell. So I took a piece of paper, spooled it into the typewriter. You young kids have no idea how satisfying it was to kind of know that you were going to produce something. Little by little, I played with the keys, chunk, 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 and a story took shape. Before long, I had a short story, my very first, something that I could be proud of, especially because I was so young. I kept writing, of course, and like a lot of young people, a lot of what I did was really derivative. I wrote a couple young adult novels when I was a young adult that were basically kind of retellings of the X-Files, except with me as the main character. I guess it was a kind of look at myself. They call that a Mary Sue, although I'm not sure if I was a true Mary Sue. I wrote screenplays. I wrote some pretend Seinfeld episodes in which I pretend I was the Jerry character and my friends were Elaine and George and Kramer. I remember obsessing over the autobiographies, yes, plural, of Isaac Asimov. I loved his autobiography work as much as I loved his novels. If you look deep in the archives of Asimov science fiction, you'll see that they published my letter, stating that one day I hope to be in their pages as an author. Well, that day hasn't come. That's okay. I haven't written much science fiction lately, but it was one of my first loves. Drama was always one of my first loves, too. I wrote a play called Montserrat, after a character from the Whit Stillman film Barcelona. Now, it wasn't very good, but I loved that play. It meant a lot to me. It also got me status as finalist in the Young Playwrights competition. That was a big deal to me, and still is. Every award, every accolade that you get, you have to take a lot of pride in, because they don't come often sometimes when we're writers. We face a lot of rejection. And I kept writing and kept writing. Went to one school for writing, left that one, went to another, finally went to grad school for writing, and here we are. I made a lot of mistakes, things that I hope young people don't do. I was always shy. I wrote a couple of screenplays that I figured, hey, I could do this. I could get the principal of my high school to let me film at night. So I wrote a Breakfast Club-type movie that would take place all at night. That way, I wouldn't be bothering anybody. I could get some friends, get a camera, make a movie. But that never happened because I didn't have the camera or the friends. When I was at one of my colleges, I had the idea, hey, look at those stairs over there. It looks like a Greek amphitheater. Why don't I stage a play there? That'd be a really cool place to put a little play. But I never did it. I guess what I'm saying to young people is to work really hard and express yourself all that you can. And never self-censor. Do what you feel you want to do. If you want to write a novel, go for it. If you want to stage a play, just do it. You're never going to be young again, and the earlier that you start doing things, the better off you'll be. Why am I all contemplative? Because I'm thinking about my own young adult novel. I've been reading a whole bunch of these since I started writing my own. And I found that young adult, the genre, is a lot of fun. The stories are all, you know, whiz-bang, there's things happening, the character's always really strong, and the authors seem to really want the reader to be engaged, sometimes in a way that literary novels don't. I love John Green's Looking for Alaska. I found that no matter how old you get, even though I'm not that old, but I'm old enough where my young adult years are kind of in my rear view, you never forget the feelings that you had when you're young. And young adult writers, when you are a young adult, should really focus on those things because they're so relatable. We all had a first love. We all had a first unrequited love. We all had the first loss of love. And these are things that people will always be able to access. So if you're out there, if you're a young person, you liked Sarah Treguet's book, fan art, you want to be a writer yourself, I say just go do it. Get a notebook. Start writing the actual story. Go on your computer, your tablet, whatever the young people have today, and just start getting it down. Because the only thing that you're going to regret is that you didn't write what you had in your head. So take it from me. Go through life, have no regrets, and leave everything you can on the page. So with that said, let's listen to my interview with the young adult writer, Sarah Treguet. All right, here we are with Sarah Treguet, author of Fan Art, a really cool young adult novel that I enjoyed greatly. How are you today, Sarah?
Wonderful, thank you.
Wonderful. Before we kind of get started, I wanted to tell you verbally, I told you in email, how I came to read your book. There's a beautiful little bookstore in Oswego, New York, right off Lake Ontario, called the River's End Bookstore. And a young lady who works there has been listening to my plight about the young adult novel I'm writing. She recommends books, and she's a really bright young lady and so enthusiastic, and it's really awesome. And so I said, well, what do you think is good? And she pointed to fan art and said, oh, my God, I thought this one was so sweet. And so I picked up the book, and I agreed that it was sweet, and I liked it a lot. So I'm really happy to be talking to you.
Wonderful.
Very cool. I guess just by way of introduction of the book, it's a very interesting book centering on Jamie, a young man in high school who, what I found interesting is that the conflict is not that he happens to be a gay teenager. I love that that's not the conflict, you know, him coming out to himself or to his family. But mm-hmm. within a few chapters, you learn that he has feelings for his best friend, Mason. Could you talk about maybe the genesis of the book or what you were thinking as you kind of came up with the idea?
Yeah, I had written a book with a gay couple in it before, and those were the father of my main character and his boyfriend. And so I had explored working with LGBT characters a little bit and got a really a warm welcome with that idea in a young adult book. And so knowing that we do need diverse books, we need books for every teenager, I kind of put that idea in the back of my mind that maybe someday I'd write a book about that. And I was hanging out with a young friend of mine. We're in a mentoring program together, and it was her senior year, and we were hanging around outside her high school waiting for an event to start. And she tells me this story about two students in her class and what happened in government class today. She's like, you would never believe what happened in government class. And I said, okay, so tell me. And my heart just hit the pavement when I heard about these students and how they pretty much outed themselves in front of the whole class that day. And I was just like, oh, that would have been horrible to be those students, to be one of those students. And so in that moment, Jamie was born in the fact that this story that my friend had told me about what had happened in her class would happen again in my fiction. So that was kind of the genesis of it, was a real life event that I heard, like, you know, third hand, it seemed.
Yeah, no, that's definitely very cool. And I'm kind of dealing with the same kinds of ideas in my young adult books and in my, like, other kind of writing. But what I find interesting is, in terms of the internal and the external conflicts, you have it's not a conflict for Jamie that he happens to be gay, and that's cool. And it's not a conflict with his family, and that's definitely cool. And even at school, the redneck character is pretty much the only character who might have a problem with that.
Right.
So I found it interesting, and especially in light of my stuff, how do you maintain conflict with something that is, you know, which is awesome for society, bad for storytelling, becoming less and less of a conflict?
Yes. Well, I'd like to think that when I wrote the book, which was a couple of years ago, that things have gotten better since then. For example, all of the gay marriage rulings, those had happened yet when I was writing the book. And while we do have some very conservative school districts here in Idaho, we also have some very wonderful schools and school districts. And I kind of said it at one of, I didn't name the school the same, but I said it at one of the most open-minded, most diverse schools, which actually was kind of ironic because Jamie just can't bring himself at the beginning of the book to come out and tell his friends, like, who he really is and how he identifies. And so it's almost an internal conflict as opposed to this external one. And my editor, my agent, and I, we all kind of collaborated to make the book. And one of the big things that we needed to decide is where Jamie was on the coming out spectrum. My young friend that I was in the mentoring program was like, do not write another book about coming out. And I'm like, but if he's out, then I have no story. So I decided to put him halfway to give myself some story room and also to go along with her request. Like, we're tired of reading books like that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Because it is true. Like, the exceptional thing now is not that a character happens to be gay. So I like the way that you kind of look at it in an oblique manner, in turning what is increasingly less of an external conflict, you know, being gay versus society, into an internal conflict, Jamie deciding how he wants to be perceived, which is very relatable because we all have, in different ways, how we want to be perceived. Very cool.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and then and you don't see Mason's side of it all, but he does have a little more external conflict within his family
that is
delaying his coming out till he feels safe, that he feels like this is an okay thing. I finished with high school. I'm moving out anyway. I can now let my family know.
So was the book always going to be at the point where the characters were going to leave? Like, if they're freshmen, you know, that's a real problem because you're not taking off soon.
Right. Yeah, the first thing I wrote was a short story, and it went from the moment in government class where Jamie slips up to the graduation prank. And that was the part that I had written first. And I had written this short story, and I sent it to my agent just to get her a little okay that I might send it off to an anthology of LGBT stories. And instead, she sent it to my editor. My editor said, oh, this would be great as a novel. I'm like, it's not a novel, it's a short story. And she's like, oh, it'd be good as a novel. But so that little part that I had was always about graduating. And I don't know, it might be a different story if they were freshmen.
Oh, definitely. And I guess since this is Great Writers Steal, you know, other people are more than welcome to write their own books about what that would be like, you know, having the same kind of conflict as a freshman.
Yeah.
I guess along those lines, I was not, you know, expecting all kinds of, you know, curse words and naughty words, but you mentioned the prank. At one point, the characters do a senior prank, and they create a large, intimidating phallus on the campus grounds, which is a time-honored, eternal thing that people do. But there weren't too many naughty words. I hate using euphemisms, but, like, at one point, you use the word shipload instead of the more vulgar alternative. Was that... Can you talk about how you decided to recreate actual teenager dialogue without using too many words that teenagers actually use?
Yes. Eden was one of my favorite characters. She is a girl from with a religious background.
Oh, definitely.
And her parents are very strict. And part of them being strict is forbidding her to swear. And so I would collect words that Eden might say. Like, I had to, like, work the whole novel to get her to say the word awesome sauce, because that was just like an Eden-like word. And so some of the fake swearing is coming out of Eden's mouth, and she'll say things that are close but not quite. In the first draft, I had Mason using more foul language and Jamie maybe on occasion, especially like when he's, you know, about to punch somebody.
Right.
But my editor and my house, they have always encouraged me to write it more emotional. And if I can write it well enough, then I don't need those words. And then with this book in particular, they were looking to have a lot of readers, and one of the things that really helps with opening up your book to a wider audience is actually taking out the swear words, because school librarians, parents, teachers sometimes feel uncomfortable sharing books with foul language in them with their students. And so my editor was very much, you know, every time I'd put one in, she'd be like, do you need this? And I'm just like, well, that's what he feels right now. But in the end, I actually kind of agreed with her. It's like, it's a sweet story. And the senior prank with the phallus was probably the worst part. And some people will not recommend the book because of that part. But I'm like, it's science. It's body parts. I don't see what's the problem. But some people do. And that's what they point out is, oh, it's a bad book because of that.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a huge conflict with me. I guess I just don't understand, because it's a book about, you know, homosexuality, which some people are offended by. There's a, you know, the giant phallus. The two boys, you know, young men, share an extremely chaste evening together. I guess that's just one thing I always wonder about, the verisimilitude of it. So it's very interesting to hear, you know, the reaction. The other thing I want to talk about is that you happen to be a graphic designer as well.
Yes.
And
I did a number of things that made the book easier for me to write because I was on a deadline, and so that was one of them.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely helps. I'm assuming that you are the artist of the Love Dare, the cartoon that appears early in the book?
Oh, no, it was my idea, but I am actually not a very good illustrator.
Oh, really? Okay.
And I don't know much about comics, and my illustrator, her name is Melissa De Jesus, and she is much more amazing than I would ever be.
Okay, no, that's very cool. Yeah, no, I liked it a lot, and I guess it ties into another question I had, because the climax of the novel, obviously you definitely had to have a huge kind of public coming out scene, because that's that, you know, that's story structure. At the graduation, the redneck character puts a picture of Jamie and Mason into the programs for graduation, and it, you know, it's a big deal. It reminds me of the film Up the Academy, which no one has ever seen. It's the it's a USA. It's a great. It's a USA Up All Night movie. It's not a great film, but it's fun. But I was fascinated as to why that picture was not included in the book. Why did you make that choice?
It was never in there. I mean, I actually tried drawing that picture several times myself, and I could never get it as vivid as it was in my imagination. And I thought that the same for readers, because young readers that I know, they're so creative. And I thought that if I left the image out, that it would be as amazing as what was in their minds.
Well, since you mentioned that, I've been exploring young adult, you know, for a few years now because of my own book. And one of the things that I really love about the genre is the enthusiasm of the readers and how they love, you know, they'll create movie trailers for the book and they'll get really involved.
Yeah.
I guess what's your relationship with those readers or how does their enthusiasm influence you in any way? Is that that's a question in there somewhere.
Yeah. It's been really great. I get emails from readers through my website, and I always welcome them, even though sometimes I don't get to reply right away. I've been guilty. But I've gotten wonderful emails about people who relate to the book, who feel like I'm telling their story. Then they have been in love with their best friend, or they haven't come out to their friends yet. And it's so wonderful to know that, you know, that there is a book for these readers, and that they can maybe not learn something from it, but you know, feel like they're not alone because they've read this book that is similar to their lives. And so it's really great to hear that enthusiasm for it. And I'd love for them to draw me pictures, and they're free to write the sequel, because...
Oh, you're not interested?
Cool.
It would be fun to see what happens with Eden and some of the other characters.
Yes, totally. I think that there's so much creativity out there. I'd love to see some.
Very cool. In terms of the narrative, to whom did you imagine that Jamie's the first person protagonist? Mm-hmm. Did you have an idea of to whom he was speaking? Because he's not literally addressing a reader, but how did you decide what he would and wouldn't reveal and that kind of thing?
I think that with his voice, I kind of imagined him, he has this computer that he carries around all the time, and I imagine that if he was brave enough, he would write his own story on this computer in some secret file that no one would ever find. And so he's kind of addressing the world, and he's kind of talking to himself from the perspective of, you know, telling the story that, you know, he won't tell Mason about his crush.
Is that another reason that the book's in present tense?
Yeah, I kind of like playing around with present tense. I've written novels in verse, and sometimes present tense works really well with verse because the poetry isn't like laden down with all these was's or words with past tense EDs on the end or whatever. So I kind of got in that mode. I wrote the short story actually in a series of poems. And then when I went to write the novel, they actually said, oh, no poetry. You need to write in actual sentences. I'm like, oh, oops. But my first draft was in poems because that was how Jamie was kind of was in my mind. And then after I wrote the first draft in poems, kind of figured out what my story was, then I went back and wrote it in paragraphs.
Yeah, I want to talk about the poetry as well, because there are, I didn't count them, but there are poems sprinkled throughout the book from a number of perspectives. I guess in terms of composition, how did you make the voices seem different? You play with the typography, or whoever at your house played with the typography, but how did you figure out how to do different voices for them?
There is a lovely writer in town that does these workshops, and sometimes she'll give you a prompt and you'll write on that for 5 or 10 minutes. And sometimes I'd go to these writing workshops and kind of think about my character a little bit before I responded to her prompt, so that I was writing from their point of view each time. And sometimes it took a few because, you know, I don't know the redneck all that well because he's not, you know, my main character. And so to figure out what his voice was in his poem was a bit of a challenge. So, yeah, sometimes I took, you know, a few tries before you landed on the perfect poem for that character.
Very cool. Yeah, I noticed that there isn't too much meter in the poems. We're all poets as well. What's your kind of poetic philosophy? Me, I tend to be more, I like writing in blank verse and having more rules to guide me. But it seems as though you're a little bit freer, and that's cool too. What kind of spark will inspire a poem for you?
Well, why I don't write in good meter is I have terrible rhythm. I can't play a musical instrument. I can't dance. And I've tried my entire life to ride horses, and actually that requires rhythm, so I've failed miserably, even though I have a horse in my backyard. So I think that maybe I have my own internal thing, and I think it sounds fine, even though there isn't really a beat or a rhythm. I think that if I read a poem out loud and it sounds like my character, then I'm good. Which might not be true, but I think I am. So that works for me, is the sound of the poetry when I hear it back again, I guess. And then, sparking the poems, I try to sometimes reveal things about the plot of the book. Like Eden talks about these boys that she wishes, you know, could be in love. And that she finds that fascinating, and that's what her poem is about. And so it's kind of like, ta-da, here's a whole book if you need it in one page. And then other ones, it expresses their frustration, such as there was a character that died and his sister writes about him and his passing, to give it a little backstory, a little depth. So yeah, they were chosen in some sense to help you understand the story.
So what's the relationship for you between narrative and poetry? Do you feel it's a more effective, briefer way of communicating a narrative?
Yes, I am fascinated by the poetry narrative combination. Like, I don't find myself drawn to poems that don't tell stories.
Okay.
But I love novels in verse. I have like lots of them, and I collect the titles and try to read as many as I can. I think that I like the turns of phrases and how you fill in the blanks between the poems to create this story as a reader and as an author. You like the stories just come together in the blank spaces.
Very cool. Yeah, every choice that you make has benefits and drawbacks. I would contend, obviously there's no right answer, but I would contend that you lose some narrative depth if you're if you're condensing a narrative. What do you feel that you're gaining by telling the same story in verse?
I think that you're gaining the... I think sometimes in prose, even beautiful prose, well thought out, very well structured prose, that sometimes the words themselves, the word choices, get muddled and lost. Somebody might, you know, say, "Oh, that's a great sentence," and pull it out and think about it in their mind. Writers will often choose the last sentence of the paragraph or of a chapter very carefully so that those particular words or wordplay or word choice will stand out to the reader. If you're telling a novel in verse, you get to do that on every page. You get to pull a punch, not just at the end of the chapter, but with every poem. And so that is always interesting to me. As for depth, I think that a good verse novel will have that depth that you need to get into a story. I do know that some readers don't connect to, they don't connect to the verse novels because they feel alienated by the choices. But then I think there's other readers that will connect to it. And with young adult, you want fast moving, you want page turning, you don't need it to be, you know, 200,000 words and 500 pages, because that's not part of the genre. It's a fast-paced, get to the heart of the story, you know, type genre. So it lends itself well to verse novels.
No, very cool. I do want to point out that I'm curious about then the relationship between the poetic nature of imagery and word combinations and how that can translate to prose, because for example, on 154, I really like your sentence. You don't have to look it up, I have it. You say, she has a stack of prints in her hand and she lays them out on a desk as if they are tarot cards. I really like that image, and that seems like something that would belong in a poem as well. Do you feel that there's a translation as well?
Yeah, I think that when you use, imagery and metaphor, and I think that good prose can have, it should be there. I don't think that prose is, like, ugly by any means. I just think that I kind of lean towards the poems, but using the same quality and everything, hopefully it's in every prose book. I don't know. It's one of those little fascinations of mine. I don't know if I ever articulated it before.
No, that's wonderful. One of the things that I like doing that I try to scale back is making pop culture references, because, you know, they go out of style. I was curious that you mentioned Darren Criss, I believe he's from Glee, the gentleman.
Right.
You mentioned Darren Criss in the book, but then on there's a part where the characters go to the movies, and it seemed like you were avoiding naming a film. I was just curious why you made that choice.
Oh, well, because I think I have hope in Darren Criss that he will continue to make amazing amazing film and television stuff. And besides, he's just, you know, the perfect person for that moment. I'm actually not really up on, like, alien movies and sci-fi and, you know, Jason Bourne type movies, so I really didn't know what to say.
That's cool. So
I avoided it there because I was just like, oh gosh, if I mention anything, it's going to be a total flop.
So the important thing is that you're saying that a reference should be judged on its relative timelessness. So, for example, it's one thing to mention Sean Connery and another thing to mention whatever flavor of the month actor might be out there.
Yeah, and also the difference in writing this book versus writing others is that I had a timeline. I knew when it was going to be published. I had a contract. I had an editor. And so I knew a little bit that it wasn't like, oh, my book might be published someday. So it was a little easier because I already had my pub date. And I figured, cool. Darren Criss is still going to be cute in 2014.
I can definitely see that. I'm not good at telling if guys are attractive. I get that one. It's hard. It's a block in my head, I think.
Right. It's okay.
That's cool. Channing Tatum. I get it. I understand. Right. He's one of those.
Right.
I get it.
And that, you know, kind of the age of the actor. You know, it's just like somebody in their 40s, you know, might think that, you know, Harrison Ford is handsome, but somebody in their who's 15 is not going to, because, oh my God, he looks like my grandpa. So you just got to pick your reader and pick your reference.
Very cool. Okay. I have some kind of basic questions that we're all kind of curious about. We never really talk about these things with each other. I'm curious, how do you usually compose your first drafts? I wrote my novel all in with my fountain pens. How do you usually compose?
Let's see. I think it depends on the project and the book and the timeline. With my first book, you know, of course you have forever to write your first book, and you can write it in pencil in a notebook, if you want. That one I kind of wrote wherever I was, and then I transposed it into the computer at a later date for my second revision. But with fan art, I had a deadline. And so I did. I typed it, even though I typed it in poems and then had this long process of going into prose. But yeah, it was my lap was very warm for my laptop.
That's a cool way to put it, yeah. So I guess that leads into what does your revision procedure generally look like? I guess for you that would involve changing poetry into prose.
Yeah, sometimes. I have some great critique groups, and so my first stuff, sometimes I bounce them off of my fellow writers here in Boise and get their feedback, like, oh, what do you think of this character? And so I had two critique groups read the short story and the beginning of fan art, and then actually after that, I had to work a little more independently without their feedback because my deadline was so close I couldn't ask them to read, oh, could you read 200 pages for next month? You know, that just was not an option. But my agent is a wonderful editor and she read many, many drafts. And her sister actually jumped in and helped us and read some. And also, my editor was very involved in the different layers and came back and said, oh, I don't like this character, or you need to change Jamie, he's too insecure, he needs a little more confidence here. And so she really, you know, shaped the book with me. It was a great process.
Very cool. I am curious, what is your general submission procedure? It might be a little bit different for you now that you have kind of things going, but
Yeah,
what are,
definitely it is.
yeah, what kind of advice or what kind of ideas do you have, you know, when you finish a piece, you have a short story, a series of linked poems, and you want to get them out? What are you thinking?
If I want to go you know, the novel route, my agent is my go-to person, like, oh, I've written this book, what do you think?
Sure,
And
sure.
sometimes she'll turn around and say, great characters, but Sarah, your plot. And then I'll just be like, okay, what do you think we should do? And so she'll send me back some ideas and like, okay, I'll do another rewrite and, you know, and send it back to her until she says, okay, yeah, I think we can go with this. But like with a short story or something, I might look for beta readers. SCBWI has these blue boards for children's writers and young adult writers, and I found a lovely beta reader. We traded stories, and she read my verse short story, and I read her verse novel, and so we shared some feedback that way. And sometimes it's good to have somebody who can read something front to back and also have a fresh point of view.
Very cool. You must have one. We all do. What is one of your narrative guilty pleasures? You, reality TV, keeping up with those Kardashian people. What kind of keeps you going?
Oh, that's a great question. Oh my goodness. Well, I am so behind the times, but I am just now watching Breaking Bad. I
Oh,
finally made
great.
it to the last season because, like, when it comes to TV shows, I want them like all. I don't want to just watch one a week. I want to watch like all of them all at once. So I'm just finishing up Breaking Bad, and my favorite TV show of all times is Dawson's Creek. And I started watching that on television in the 1990s, and I do now have all of the episodes, but I actually haven't finished watching it yet. I've been watching it for like 20 years or something.
No, those are both good shows. You might also enjoy Veronica Mars, if you haven't seen
Yes, I've
Veronica
heard good
Mars.
things about that.
Oh, it's a
Yes, I
fantastic
should
show.
try that when I finish Breaking Bad.
Yeah, and there's nothing guilty about Breaking Bad. That's a fantastic show. Like it's a classic, obviously.
Yes. it's very well done.
Yeah. I'm curious, you mentioned a lot of the people who help you. I'd love to give you the opportunity to shout out to some of your primary mentors in writing.
Oh, let's see. Like, some of my favorite authors are Sonia Sones and Chris Crutcher. And let's see. Yes, my critique groups are wonderful. And my agent is Danielle Ciotti, and she has been so helpful with everything. So, yeah, it's been good.
Very cool. And most importantly, what should we look for from you next?
Oh, well, I am trying a little bit of middle grade because I thought I wanted to write something a little shorter and that maybe it wouldn't take me as long to write a
Hello, I am Kenneth Nichols here with the Great Writers Guild podcast. Today, we have an interview with a very interesting person, Sarah Tregay, the author of Fan Art, a very cool young adult book that you should all pick up from Catherine Tegan Books. Very enjoyable novel about a young man named Jamie who has some problems, but also has some hopes in life. Ms. Tregay talks about how she got her book published, how it was shaped by her agent and her publisher, talks about how she introduced conflict in the book, and all those other kinds of things that writers really need to know. You'll also hear about her love of novels written in verse, and how much she enjoys her fans and interacting with them and enjoying all of the enthusiasm they bring to her work. But first, because this is a book for young adults, written by an adult, I wanted to reflect a little bit on my own experience. There's probably a lot of you out there who might be young adult, young kids, and want to be a writer. Well, you know what? That's all I've ever wanted to be. I remember when I was a kid always wanting to write poems. At one point, I even thought I could write a sequel to A Christmas Story. You know, Ralphie and his brother and all those cool stories. Little did I know that Gene Shepard already did it. I remember going to school on the bus with what I called my poem kit. A red pencil box that had some pens and pencils and note cards, anything I could jot ideas down onto. I don't think I really became a real writer until the day when I was about 12 or 13 years old, when I took my dad's Smith Corona electric typewriter out of its faux leather case and plugged it in, because I had an idea. I had an idea for a story that I wanted to tell. So I took a piece of paper, spooled it into the typewriter. You young kids have no idea how satisfying it was to kind of know that you were going to produce something. Little by little, I played with the keys, chunk, 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 and a story took shape. Before long, I had a short story, my very first, something that I could be proud of, especially because I was so young. I kept writing, of course, and like a lot of young people, a lot of what I did was really derivative. I wrote a couple young adult novels when I was a young adult, that were basically kind of retellings of the X-Files, except with me as the main character. I guess it was a kind of look at myself. They call that a Mary Sue, although I'm not sure if I was a true Mary Sue. I wrote screenplays. I wrote some pretend Seinfeld episodes in which I pretend I was the Jerry character and my friends were Elaine and George and Kramer. I remember obsessing over the autobiographies, yes, plural, of Isaac Asimov. I loved his autobiography work as much as I loved his novels. If you look deep in the archives of Asimov science fiction, you'll see that they published my letter, stating that one day I hope to be in their pages as an author. Well, that day hasn't come. That's okay. I haven't written much science fiction lately, but it was one of my first loves. Drama was always one of my first loves, too. I wrote a play called Montserrat, after a character from the Whit Stillman film Barcelona. Now, it wasn't very good, but I loved that play. It meant a lot to me. It also got me status as finalist in the Young Playwrights competition. That was a big deal to me, and still is. Every award, every accolade that you get, you have to take a lot of pride in, because they don't come often sometimes when we're writers. We face a lot of rejection. And I kept writing and kept writing. Went to one school for writing. Left that one, went to another. finally went to grad school for writing, and here we are. I made a lot of mistakes, things that I hope young people don't do. I was always shy. I wrote a couple of screenplays that I figured, hey, I could do this. I could get the principal of my high school to let me film at night. So I wrote a Breakfast Club-type movie that would take place all at night. That way, I wouldn't be bothering anybody. I could get some friends, get a camera, make a movie. But that never happened because I didn't have the camera or the friends. When I was at one of my colleges, I had the idea, hey, look at those stairs over there. It looks like a Greek amphitheater. Why don't I stage a play there? That'd be a really cool place to put a little play. But I never did it. I guess what I'm saying to young people is to work really hard and express yourself all that you can. And never self-censor. Do what you feel you want to do. If you want to write a novel, go for it. If you want to stage a play, just do it. You're never going to be young again, and the earlier that you start doing things, the better off you'll be. Why am I all contemplative? Because I'm thinking about my own young adult novel. I've been reading a whole bunch of these since I started writing my own, and I found that young adult, the genre, is a lot of fun. The stories are all, you know, whiz-bang, there's things happening, the character's always really strong, and the authors seem to really want the reader to be engaged, sometimes in a way that literary novels don't. I love John Green's Looking for Alaska. I found that no matter how old you get, even though I'm not that old, but I'm old enough where my young adult years are kind of in my rear view, you never forget the feelings that you had when you're young. And young adult writers, when you are a young adult, should really focus on those things because they're so relatable. We all had a first love. We all had a first unrequited love. We all had the first loss of love. And these are things that people will always be able to access. So if you're out there, if you're a young person, you liked Sarah Treguet's book, fan art, you want to be a writer yourself, I say just go do it. Get a notebook. Start writing the actual story. Go on your computer, your tablet, whatever the young people have today, and just start getting it down. Because the only thing that you're going to regret is that you didn't write what you had in your head. So take it from me. Go through life, have no regrets, and leave everything you can on the page. So with that said, let's listen to my interview with the young adult writer, Sarah Treguet. All right, here we are with Sarah Treguet, author of Fan Art, a really cool young adult novel that I enjoyed greatly. How are you today, Sarah?
Wonderful, thank you.
Wonderful. Before we kind of get started, I wanted to tell you verbally, I told you in email, how I came to read your book. There's a beautiful little bookstore in Oswego, New York, right off Lake Ontario, called the River's End Bookstore. And a young lady who works there has been listening to my plight about the young adult novel I'm writing. She recommends books, and she's a really bright young lady and so enthusiastic, and it's really awesome. And so I said, well, what do you think is good? And she pointed to fan art and said, oh, my God, I thought this one was so sweet. And so I picked up the book, and I agreed that it was sweet, and I liked it a lot. So I'm really happy to be talking to you.
Wonderful.
Very cool. I guess just by way of introduction of the book, it's a very interesting book centering on Jamie, a young man in high school who, what I found interesting is that the conflict is not that he happens to be a gay teenager. I love that that's not the conflict, you know, him coming out to himself or to his family. But mm-hmm. within a few chapters, you learn that he has feelings for his best friend, Mason. Could you talk about maybe the genesis of the book or what you were thinking as you kind of came up with the idea?
Yeah, I had written a book with a gay couple in it before, and those were the father of my main character and his boyfriend. And so I had explored working with LGBT characters a little bit and got a really a warm welcome with that idea in a book, in a young adult book. And so knowing that we do need diverse books, we need books for every teenager, I kind of put that idea in the back of my mind that maybe someday I'd write a book about that. And I was hanging out with a young friend of mine. We're in a mentoring program together, and it was her senior year, and we were hanging around outside her high school waiting for an event to start. And she tells me this story about two students in her class and what happened in government class today. She's like, "You would never believe what happened in government class." And I said, "Okay, so tell me." And like my heart just hit the pavement when I heard about these students and how they pretty much outed themselves in front of the whole class that day. And I was just like, "Oh, that would have been horrible to be those students, to be one of those students." And so in that moment, Jamie was born, in the fact that this story that my friend had told me about what had happened in her class would happen again in my fiction. So that was kind of the genesis of it, was a real life event that I heard, like, you know, third hand, it seemed.
Yeah, no, that's definitely very cool. And I'm kind of dealing with those, the same kinds of ideas in my young adult books and in my, like, other kind of writing. But what I find interesting is, in terms of the internal and the external conflicts, you have it's not a conflict for Jamie that he happens to be gay, and that's cool. And it's not a conflict with his family, and that's definitely cool. And even at school, the redneck character is pretty much the only character who might have a problem with that.
Right.
So I found it interesting, and especially in light of my stuff, how do you maintain conflict with something that is, you know, which is awesome for society, bad for storytelling, becoming less and less of a conflict?
Yes. Well, I'd like to think that when I wrote the book, which was a couple of years ago, that things have gotten better since then. For example, all of the gay marriage rulings, those had happened yet when I was writing the book. And while we do have some very conservative school districts here in Idaho, we also have some very wonderful schools and school districts. And I kind of said it at one of, I didn't name the school the same, but I said it at one of the most open-minded, most diverse schools, which, actually was kind of ironic because Jamie just can't bring himself at the beginning of the book to come out and tell his friends, like, who he really is and how he identifies. And, so it's almost an internal conflict, as opposed to this external one. And my editor, my agent, and I, we all kind of collaborated to make the book. And one of the big things that we needed to decide is where Jamie was on the coming out spectrum. My young friend that I was in the mentoring program was like, "Do not write another book about coming out." And I'm like, "But if he's out, then I have no story." So I decided to put him halfway, to give myself some story room and also to go along with her request. Like, we're tired of reading books like that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, because it is true. Like, the exceptional thing now is not that a character happens to be gay. So I like the way that you kind of look at it in an oblique manner. Turning what is increasingly less of an external conflict, you know, being gay versus society, into an internal conflict, Jamie deciding how he wants to be perceived, which is very relatable because we all have, in different ways, how we want to be perceived. Very cool.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and then, and you don't see Mason's side of it all, but he does have a little more external conflict within his family.
That is
delaying his coming out till he feels safe, that he feels like this is an okay thing. I finished with high school. I'm moving out anyway. I can now let my family know.
So was the book always going to be at the point where the characters were going to leave? Like, if they're freshmen, you know, that's a real problem because you're not taking off soon.
Right. Yeah, the first thing I wrote was a short story, and it went from the moment in government class where Jamie slips up up to the graduation prank and that was the part that I had written first. And I had written this short story, and I sent it to my agent just to get her a little okay that I might send it off to an anthology of LGBT stories. And instead, she sent it to my editor. My editor said, oh, this would be great as a novel. I'm like, it's not a novel, it's a short story. And she's like, oh, it'd be good as a novel. But so that little part that I had was always about graduating. And I don't know, it might be a different story if they were freshmen.
Oh, definitely. And I guess since this is Great Writers Steal, you know, other people are more than welcome to write their own books about what that would be like, you know, having the same kind of conflict as a freshman. I guess along those lines, I was not, you know, expecting all kinds of, you know, curse words and naughty words, but you mentioned the prank. At one point, the characters do a senior prank, and they create a large, intimidating phallus on the campus grounds, which is a time-honored, eternal thing that people do. But there weren't too many naughty words. I hate using euphemisms, but, like, at one point, you use the word shipload instead of the more vulgar alternative. Was that... can you talk about how you decided to recreate actual teenager dialogue without using too many words that teenagers actually use?
Yes. Eden was one of my favorite characters. She is a girl from with a religious background.
Oh, definitely.
And her parents are very strict. And part of them being strict is forbidding her to swear. And so I would collect words that Eden might say. Like, I had to, like, work the whole novel to get her to say the word awesome sauce, because that was just like an Eden-like word. And so some of the fake swearing is coming out of Eden's mouth, and she'll say things that are close but not quite. In the first draft, I had Mason using more foul language, and Jamie maybe on occasion, especially like when he's, you know, about to punch somebody.
Right.
But my editor and my house, they have always encouraged me to write it more emotional. And if I can write it well enough, then I don't need those words. And then with this book in particular, they were looking to have a lot of readers, and one of the things that really helps with opening up your book to a wider audience is actually taking out the swear words, because school librarians, parents, teachers sometimes feel uncomfortable sharing books with foul language in them with their students. And so my editor was very much, you know, every time I'd put one in, she'd be like, do you need this? And I'm just like, well, that's what he feels right now. But in the end, I actually kind of agreed with her. It's like, it's a sweet story. And the senior prank with the phallus was probably the worst part. And some people will not recommend the book because of that part. But I'm like, it's science. It's body parts. I don't see what's the problem. But some people do. And that's what they point out is, oh, it's a bad book because of that.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a huge conflict with me. I guess I just don't understand, because it's a book about, you know, homosexuality, which some people are offended by. There's a, you know, the giant phallus. The two boys, you know, young men, share an extremely chaste evening together. I guess that's just one thing I always wonder about, the verisimilitude of it. So it's very interesting to hear, you know, the reaction. The other thing I want to talk about is that you happen to be a graphic designer as well.
Yes.
And
I did a number of things that made the book easier for me to write, because I was on a deadline, and so that was one of them.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely helps. I'm assuming that you are the artist of the Love Dare, the cartoon that appears early in the book?
Oh, no, it was my idea, but I am actually not a very good illustrator.
Oh, really? Okay.
And I don't know much about comics, and my illustrator, her name is Melissa De Jesus, and she is much more amazing than I would ever be.
Okay, no, that's very cool. Yeah, no, I liked it a lot, and I guess it ties into Another question I had, because the climax of the novel, obviously you definitely had to have a huge kind of public coming out scene, because that's that, you know, that's story structure. So at the graduation, the redneck character puts a picture of Jamie and Mason into the programs for graduation. And it, you know, it's a big deal. It reminds me of the film Up the Academy, which no one has ever seen. It's the it's a USA. It's a great. It's a USA Up All Night movie. It's not a great film, but it's fun. But what I was fascinated as to why that picture was not included in the book. Why did you make that choice?
It was never in there. I mean, I actually tried drawing that picture several times myself, and I could never get it as vivid as it was in my imagination. And I thought that the same for readers, because young readers that I know, they're so creative. And I thought that if I left the image out, that it would be as amazing as what was in their minds.
Well, since you mentioned that, I've been exploring young adult, you know, for a few years now because of my own book. And one of the things that I really love about the genre is the enthusiasm of the readers and how they love, you know, they'll create movie trailers for the book and they'll get really involved. I guess what's your relationship with those readers, or how does their enthusiasm influence you in any way? Is that that's a question in there somewhere.
Yeah. It's been really great. I get emails from readers through my website, and I always welcome them, even though sometimes I don't get to reply right away. I've been guilty. But I've gotten wonderful emails about people who relate to the book, who feel like I'm telling their story. Then they have been in love with their best friend, or they haven't come out to their friends yet. And it's so wonderful to know that, you know, that there is a book for these readers, and that they can maybe not learn something from it, but you know, feel like they're not alone because they've read this book that is similar to their lives. And so it's really great to hear that enthusiasm for it. And I'd love for them to draw me pictures, and they're free to write the sequel, because...
Oh, you're not interested? Cool. It would be fun to see what happens with Eden and some of the other characters.
Yes, totally. I think that there's so much creativity out there. I'd love to see some.
Very cool. In terms of the narrative, to whom did you imagine that Jamie's the first person protagonist? Did you have an idea of to whom he was speaking? Because he's not literally addressing a reader, but how did you decide what he would and wouldn't reveal and that kind of thing?
I think that I... With his voice, I kind of imagined him, he has this computer that he carries around all the time, and I imagine that if he was brave enough, he would write his own story on this computer in some secret file that no one would ever find. And so he's kind of addressing the world, and he's kind of talking to himself from the perspective of, you know, telling the story that, you know, he won't tell Mason about his crush.
Is that another reason that the book's in present tense?
Yeah, I kind of like playing around with present tense. I've written novels in verse, and sometimes present tense works really well with verse, because the poetry isn't like laden down with all these was's or words with past tense EDs on the end or whatever. So I kind of got in that mode. I wrote the short story actually in a series of poems. And then when I went to write the novel, they actually said, oh, no poetry. You need to write in actual sentences. I'm like, oh, oops. But my first draft was in poems, because that was how Jamie was kind of was in my mind. And then after I wrote the first draft in poems, kind of figured out what my story was, then I went back and wrote it in paragraphs.
Yeah, I want to talk about the poetry as well, because there are, I didn't count them, but there are poems sprinkled throughout the book from a number of perspectives. I guess in terms of composition, how did you make the voices seem different? You play with the typography, or whoever at your house played with the typography, but how did you figure out how to do different voices for them?
There is a lovely writer in town that does these workshops, and sometimes she'll give you a prompt and you'll write on that for 5 or 10 minutes. And sometimes I'd go to these writing workshops and kind of think about my character a little bit before I responded to her prompt, so that I was writing from their point of view each time. And sometimes it took a few, because, you know, I don't know the redneck all that well, because he's not, you know, my main character. And so to figure out what his voice was in his poem was a bit of a challenge. So, yeah, sometimes they took, you know, a few tries before you landed on the perfect poem for that character.
Very cool. Yeah, I noticed that there isn't too much meter in the poems. We're all poets as well. What's your kind of poetic philosophy? Me, I tend to be more, I like writing in blank verse and having more rules to guide me. But it seems as though you're a little bit freer, and that's cool too. What kind of spark will inspire a poem for you?
Well, why I don't write in good meter is I have terrible rhythm. I can't play a musical instrument. I can't dance. And I've tried my entire life to ride horses, and actually that requires rhythm, so I've failed miserably, even though I have a horse in my backyard. So I think that maybe I have my own internal thing, and I think it sounds fine, even though there isn't really a beat or a rhythm. I think that if I read a poem out loud and it sounds like my character, then I'm good. Which might not be true, but I think I am. So that works for me, is the sound of the poetry when I hear it back again, I guess. And then, sparking the poems, I try to sometimes reveal things about the plot of the book. Like Eden talks about these boys that she wishes, you know, could be in love. And that she finds that fascinating. And that's what her poem is about. And so it's kind of like, ta-da, here's a whole book if you need it in one page. And then other ones, it expresses their frustration, such as there was a character that died and his sister writes about him and his passing, to give it a little backstory, a little depth. So they were chosen in some sense to help you understand the story.
So what's the relationship for you between narrative and poetry? Do you feel it's a more effective, briefer way of communicating a narrative?
Yes, I am fascinated by the poetry narrative combination. Like, I don't find myself drawn to poems that don't tell stories.
Okay.
But I love novels in verse. I have like lots of them, and I collect the titles and try to read as many as I can. I think that I like the turns of phrases and how you fill in the blanks between the poems to create this story as a reader and as an author. You like, the stories just come together in the blank spaces.
Very cool. Yeah, every choice that you make has benefits and drawbacks. I would contend, obviously there's no right answer, but I would contend that you lose some narrative depth if you're if you're condensing a narrative. What do you feel that you're gaining by telling the same story in verse?
I think that you're gaining the... I think sometimes in prose, even beautiful prose, well thought out, very well structured prose, that sometimes the words themselves, the word choices, get muddled, and and loss, somebody might, you know, say, oh, that's a great sentence, and pull it out and think about it in their mind. Or writers will often choose the last sentence of the paragraph or of a chapter very carefully so that those particular words or wordplay or word choice will stand out to the reader. If you're telling a novel in verse, you get to do that on every page. You get to pull a punch, not just at the end of the chapter, but with every poem. And so that is always interesting to me. As for depth, I think that a good verse novel will have that depth that you need to get into a story. I do know that some readers don't connect to the verse novels because they feel alienated by the choices. But then I think there's other readers that will connect to it. And with young adult, you want fast moving, you want page turning, you don't need it to be, you know, 200,000 words and 500 pages, because that's not part of the genre. It's a fast paced, get to the heart of the story, you know, type genre. So it lends itself well to verse novels.
No, very cool. I do want to point out that I'm curious about then the relationship between the poetic nature of imagery and word combinations and how that can translate to prose, because for example, on 154, I really like your sentence. You don't have to look it up, I have it. You say, she has a stack of prints in her hand and she lays them out on a desk as if they are tarot cards. I really like that image, and that seems like something that would belong in a poem as well. Do you feel that there's a translation as well?
Yeah, I think that when you use, imagery and metaphor, and I think that good prose can have, it should be there. I don't think that prose is like ugly by any means. I just think that I kind of lean towards the poems, but using the same quality and everything. Hopefully it's in every prose book. I don't know. It's one of those little fascinations of mine. I don't know if I ever articulated it before.
No, that's wonderful. One of the things that I like doing that I try to scale back is making pop culture references. Because, you know, they go out of style. I was curious that you mentioned Darren Criss, I believe he's from Glee, the gentleman.
Right.
You mentioned Darren Criss in the book, but then on there's a part where the characters go to the movies, and it seemed like you were avoiding naming a film. I was just curious why you made that choice.
Oh, well, because I think I have hope in Darren Criss that he will continue to make amazing amazing film and television stuff. And besides, he's just, you know, the perfect person for that moment. I'm actually not really up on like alien movies and sci-fi and you know, Jason Bourne type movies, so I really didn't know what to say.
That's cool. So
I avoided it there because I was just like, oh gosh, if I mention anything, it's gonna be a total flop.
So the important thing is that you're saying that a reference should be judged on its relative timelessness. So, for example, it's one thing to mention Sean Connery and another thing to mention whatever flavor of the month actor might be out there.
Yeah, and also the difference in writing this book versus writing others is that I had a timeline. I knew when it was going to be published. I had a contract. I had an editor. And so I knew a little bit that it wasn't like, oh, my book might be published someday. So it was a little easier because I already had my pub date. And I figured, cool. Oh, Darren Criss is still going to be cute in 2014.
I can definitely see that. I'm not good at telling if guys are attractive. I get that one. It's hard. It's a block in my head, I think.
Right. It's okay.
That's cool. Channing Tatum, I get it. I understand, right? He's one of those.
And that, you know, kind of the age of the actor. You know, it's just like somebody in their 40s, you know, might think that, you know, Harrison Ford is handsome, but somebody in their who's 15 is not going to, because, oh my God, he looks like my grandpa. So you just got to pick your reader and pick your reference.
Very cool. Okay, I have some kind of basic questions that we're all kind of curious about. We never really talk about these things with each other, I'm curious, how do you usually compose your first drafts? I wrote my novel all in with my fountain pens. How do you usually compose?
Let's see. I think it depends on the project and the book and the timeline. With my first book, you know, of course you have forever to write your first book, and you can write it in pencil in a notebook, if you want. That one I kind of wrote wherever I was, and then I transposed it into the computer at a later date for my second revision. But with fan art, I had a deadline. And so I did. I typed it, even though I typed it in poems and then had this long process of going into prose. But yeah, it was my lap was very warm from my laptop.
That's a cool way to put it, yeah. So I guess that leads into, what does your revision procedure generally look like? I guess for you that would involve changing poetry into prose.
Yeah, sometimes. I have some great critique groups, and so my first stuff, sometimes I bounce them off of my fellow writers here in Boise and get their feedback, like, oh, what do you think of this character? And so I had two critique groups read the short story and the beginning of fan art, and then actually after that I had to work a little more independently without their feedback, because my deadline was so close I couldn't ask them to read, oh, could you read 200 pages for next month? You know, that just was not an option. But my agent is a wonderful editor, and she read many, many drafts. And her sister actually jumped in and helped us and read some. And also my editor was very involved in the different layers and came back and said, oh, I don't like this character, or you need to change Jamie. He's too insecure. He needs a little more confidence here. And so she really, you know, shaped the book with me. It was a great process.
Very cool. I am curious, what is your general submission procedure? It might be a little bit different for you now that you have kind of things going. But what kind of advice or what kind of ideas do you have, you know, when you finish a piece, you have a short story, a series of linked poems, and you want to get them out? What are you thinking?
If I want to go, you know, the novel route, my agent is my go-to person. Like, oh, I've written this book, what do you think?
Sure.
And sometimes she'll turn around and say, great characters, but Sarah, your plot. And then I'll just be like, okay, what do you think we should do? And so she'll send me back some ideas and like, okay, I'll do another rewrite. And, you know, and send it back to her until she says, okay, yeah, I think we can go with this. But like with a short story or something, I might look for beta readers. SCBWI has these blue boards for children's writers and young adult writers. And I found a lovely beta reader. We traded stories, and she read my verse short story, and I read her verse novel. And so we shared some feedback that way. And sometimes it's good to have somebody who can read something front to back and also have a fresh point of view.
Very cool. You must have one. We all do. What is one of your narrative guilty pleasures? Reality TV, keeping up with those Kardashian people. What kind of keeps you going?
Oh, that's a great question. Oh, my goodness. I am so behind the times, but I am just now watching Breaking Bad. I finally made it to the last season because, like, when it comes to TV shows, I want them, like, all. I don't want to just watch one a week. I want to watch, like, all of them all at once. So I'm just finishing up Breaking Bad, and my favorite TV show of all times is Dawson's Creek. And I started watching that on television in the 1990s, and I do now have all of the episodes, but I actually haven't finished watching it yet. I've been watching it for like 20 years or something.
No, those are both good shows. You might also enjoy Veronica Mars, if you haven't seen Veronica Mars.
Yes, I've heard good things about that.
Oh, it's a fantastic show.
I should try that when I finish Breaking Bad.
Yeah, and there's nothing guilty about Breaking Bad. That's a fantastic show. Like, it's a classic, obviously.
Yes. It's very well done.
Yeah. I'm curious, you mentioned a lot of the people who help you. I'd love to give you the opportunity to shout out to some of your primary mentors in writing.
Oh, let's see. Like, some of my favorite authors are Sonia Sones and Chris Crutcher. And let's see. Yes, my critique groups are wonderful. And my agent is Danielle Ciotti, and she has been so helpful with everything. So, yeah, it's been good.
Very cool. And most importantly, what should we look for from you next?
Oh, well, I am trying a little bit of middle grade because I thought I wanted to write something a little shorter and that maybe it wouldn't take me as long to write a short novel. But that is not true. It is so much harder to write a short novel than a long one. So, yes, I have a middle grade story that my agent and I are working on, but I don't know if it's any easier or if it's just the same.
Well, that's fascinating. Is wonderful. I want to thank you, Sarah Turgay, for talking to me. Everybody should go out and pick up, regardless of age, because it's a timeless story we can all relate to. We've all had unrequited love. We were all a kid once. Pick up Fan Art from Catherine Teagan Books, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
So what do you think, friends? Isn't Mr. Gay a really interesting and fun and cool person? If you haven't already, go ahead and check out her books. You can find a link to everything in the description if you're watching on YouTube. You can go to my site, www.greatwritersteel.com, to find out more about her, or the good old-fashioned saratregay.com to find out more about this author. What have we learned? It's always important to summarize, isn't it? No matter your age, if you're a young adult, or a young adult writer who happens to be an adult, be open to the story ideas all around you. That's how Mr. Gay came up with the idea for a fan art. It started as one thing, and it became another. Maybe you carry a notebook around with you. Maybe you just listen for stories in the news. But whatever it is, you have to make sure that you're open to having your mindset changed. You should love your characters. It's incredibly obvious that Mr. Gay really loves Jamie and Mason and all of the other characters in the book. Even the bad characters, the ones that who do bad things, you don't have to literally love them, think they're cool people, but you should have some kind of understanding of them as a whole person, because that will bleed through to the page. I know it's hard sometimes, but we should learn how to take criticism from others and how to accept it. Mr. Gay changed the course of her book a little bit based upon what her agent and her publisher told her. Now, you and I, we may not have agents and publishers, but we do have friends, we do have acquaintances, we do have workshop helpers. Those people are just trying to help us. Believe you me, I've had experiences where it wasn't the best experience when it comes to people criticizing my work. But in general, everything is all out of love, so no matter what people tell you, they're trying to help you just as you are trying to help them. But most of all, no matter your age, no matter your genre, what should you do? You should just write. Right now, go get a pen, go get a piece of paper, and just start creating. That's all for now. Remember, I'm Kenneth Nichols for Great Writers Steel. Shakespeare did it, so should you.